Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. On Ukraine, the UN Secretary General said on Wednesday that he did not believe that there was an opportunity to organize a serious peace negotiation between the warring parties yet. Despite that sobering assessment, Antonio Guterres told the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, Switzerland, that he remained committed to alleviating the suffering of Ukrainians and vulnerable people in the wider world still reeling from the conflict's dramatic, devastating impacts on the global economy.
There will be a end of this war. There is a end of everything. But I do not see an end of the war in the immediate future, unfortunately. I do not see a chance at the present moment to have a serious peace negotiation between the two parties.
Reiterating that the Russian invasion of Ukraine violated international law and the UN Charter, the Secretary General underscored the difficulty of ending the violence when the two sides continue to have such fundamentally different ideas about each other's history. With Ukrainian and Russian fighters entrenched in Ukraine, Mr. Guterres insisted that the UN had nonetheless helped to secure the support of Kiev and Moscow to ship desperately needed grain and fertilizer to countries facing or trying to ward off spiraling food insecurity. Small island developing states have among the highest rates of non-communicable diseases and mental health risks in the world, which is why the UN Health Agency said on Wednesday that it's taking part in a new push to help people there stay well. According to the World Health Organization, WHO, more than one in two people in developing small island nations die prematurely from preventable diseases. These include high blood pressure, which affects more than 3 in 10 citizens from those countries. The UN Health Agency's new data portal also showed that 10 of the countries with the highest rates of obesity worldwide are small island states, which also have the highest rates of diabetes among adults in the world. In part, this is because they are disproportionately exposed to the impact of the climate crisis on both physical and mental health, WHO said. Based on discussions with affected communities and meetings between the WHO, the government of Barbados, and the Pan American Health Organization, new recommendations have been agreed to scale up action on non-communicable diseases and mental health. These include accelerating the early detection, prevention, and management of disease and mental health conditions across small island developing states, and also strengthening health systems to cope with the climate crisis and COVID-19 pandemic. To the Security Council, which heard a worrying assessment on Wednesday about spiraling insecurity in the West Bank. In an update to the Council, the UN's Special Coordinator on the Situation in the Middle East, Tor Wensland, described armed exchanges between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians. He said that between the 8th of December and the 13th of January, 14 Palestinians were killed, including 5 children, during demonstrations, clashes, search and arrest operations, attacks and alleged attacks against Israelis. Israeli settlers or other civilians also perpetrated more than 60 attacks against Palestinians, Mr. Wensland continued, resulting in 28 injuries, including 6 children. Area A of the occupied West Bank saw a high proportion of all casualties, the UN official noted. He reiterated that all perpetrators of all acts of violence must be held accountable and swiftly brought to justice. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with economics professor Richard Wolff, who's recently written the book, The Sickness is in the System.
He demonstrates how the working people of America suffer under the capitalist system and what perhaps needs to be done and can be done to change that. We'll also talk with the executive director of Adala Justice Project about the plight of the Palestinian people and how the new Israeli right-wing government threatens their status even more.
Our guest is Sandra Tamari, a Palestinian-American woman who will tell us what's going on. Terrible stuff in Israel.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
We all know almost instinctively that there's a connection between politics and economics. Today, we talk with Professor Richard Wolff about that connection. We live in a world in economic turmoil, all the more so because the U.S. and NATO proxy war against Russia and Ukraine. At home in the USA, we have the greatest wealth disparity and income disparity in a century. When Standard Oil, now Exxon, owner John D. Rockefeller died, he was worth $3 billion. Now Jeff Bezos is worth about $180 billion. There's not been a national increase in the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour in decades. Half the people in America are poor or near poor. Bezos and two other billionaires own as much as the bottom half of the population of our country. There's been a dramatic change and increase in labor militancy by American workers not seen since just before and just after World War II. U.S. world hegemony is starting to fray, even as the military budget increases. This month, Congress passed a budget bill with half of it going to the military. The military got $45 billion more than it even asked for. What's going on? What are the prospects for political action independent of the two capitalist parties, the Republicans and the Democrats? We speak today with Richard Wolff. He's the Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And he's the visiting professor, the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York City. He's the founder of Democracy at Work and host of the nationally syndicated show Economic Update. His latest book is The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself, which can be found along with his other books, Understanding Socialism and Understanding Marxism, at www.democracyatwork.info. Richard Wolff, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here, Michael, really, very glad.
Rick, there's a line from an old song that goes, "The rich get rich and the poor get poorer, ain't we got fun?" When John D. Rockefeller, the owner of Standard Oil, now Exxon, died years ago, he was worth $3 billion. And now we've got Jeff Bezos of Amazon worth $180 billion. The three richest men in America are worth as much as the bottom half of the population. So if the rich are so rich, who's poor and why?
Well, the simple answer is that for the last 40 years, roughly since the 1980s, we have seen here in the United States a radical redistribution of wealth. From the bottom and the middle, wealth has been transferred to the people at the top. We used to say people at the top, meaning 10%, the top 10%. Now it's really the top 1%. It turns out that the Wall Street folks back in 2011, the Occupy Wall Street group, were absolutely right in targeting the 1%. And the way that was done was three things. Number one, changing the tax laws so that taxes fell more and more on the middle and the bottom and less on those at the top. The second way it was done is more recent. The pandemic was used to move wealth that way, and the inflation that we're living through now is yet another way. The inflation right now, prices going up 8 to 10%, wages going up 3 to 4%. That's a simple story in which wealth is transferred from the middle and the bottom, the people who pay the rising prices, relative to what happens at the top. Wages are the money paid by the folks at the top to us, only going up 3 or 4%, and prices, what they get out of us, going up twice that amount. When you do this for decades, you get the kinds of results you're just asking about.
I wonder, too, Rick, the amount of money, the amount of debt owed by Americans is really quite staggering, and it's only getting worse with inflation. There hasn't been any real movement yet on the student debt relief, no significant increase in the minimum wage, no extension of child credits, and I could go on and on. Why is this the case? What accounts for this extraordinary debt on behalf of our folks?
Well, again, I could bore you with the details, but I can summarize them this way. The level of debt of the United States government to the people it borrows from is higher than at any point in our history. The level of debt of corporations in the United States is higher than it has ever been in our history, and the debt of households, of families, likewise. We are a debt-ridden society on a scale and at a level never before seen in American history. Why? Because the government could not function by raising taxes. Politically, those who are the big rich donors will not donate to politicians who tax them. And the mass of people literally don't have the money anymore, so you can't tax them. Plus, they'll vote against you. So the government is in debt. Corporations are having such difficulty in the world economy that they're borrowing like crazy for the same. And then when you get to the working class, they're not being paid enough. Their real wages haven't gone up for the last 30 years. And as a result, in order to get even close to the American dream, they have to borrow like crazy. But there's a general reason behind this that I want quickly to say. The American economy exploded in growth from around the Civil War to around the 1970s, an incredible period over a century of, at least for white Americans, being better off. That period is over. The American explosion of wealth is no longer what it was. Just like the American empire is not able to run the world economy the way it did for most of World War II, after World War II. And that's what we're adjusting to. We cannot be in the dominant position we once were, and so we solve our economic decline by borrowing from the rest of the world and from one another. And if you're thinking this is a story whose ending will not be good, you're exactly right. This cannot continue, but we have leaders that are much more interested in their careers who deny all of this than we are with leaders who will tell us honestly that this is going on and then come up with a plan for how to deal with it.
Yeah, well, Rick, things are certainly getting worse with inflation. I have a simple question. Why do we have inflation, especially in the last couple of months? It's incredible.
Well, you know, those simple questions like yours, Michael, are often the best, and they are in this case too. So let me ask you to suspend for a minute the junk you hear in the mainstream media and follow me with the simple answer to your question. Inflation simply means that prices are in general going up. That's the literal definition. It doesn't mean that every price goes up. It doesn't mean that prices all go up by the same amount, percentages, or absolute. It just means prices are going up. All right, now step two. How and why do prices go up? Well, the answer is in no way mysterious. Employers set prices. Employees don't. Everyone listening to this conversation knows that if you've been an employer in your life, you've been part of the process of setting prices, raising them, lowering them, deciding to keep them the same. Whereas if you're an employee, you know that you have never been involved in that decision. That's not part of your job description. Okay, employers are less than 1% of the population of the United States. So when inflation means we are allowing, as a people, less than 1% of our members, of our population, the employers amongst us, to set the price that the rest of us have to pay as employees. And the answer is to the question, why do employers raise prices? Because that's what an inflation is. The answer is employers do that for the same reason they do everything else, to maximize their profits. That's what they're in business to do. That's what they learned at the Master of Business Administration course they took at the business school. You make decisions based on what's good for your profits. So when they raise prices, when we have an inflation, it's because they are doing the most profitable act they can, and in this case, it's raising prices. And until it has a different effect, we will have an inflation accompanied by lots of verbs and verbiage about how we're fighting it.
Rick Wolf, a piece of good news, I think we'd all agree, there has been somewhat of an upturn in labor militancy over the last few years. Teachers, railroad workers, nurses, warehouse workers, Starbucks baristas are organizing. How do you account for this recent upturn in labor militancy and that we've been witnessing?
Well, I think basically it's a reaction to everything we've just been discussing in the last few minutes. In other words, if you take wealth away from the mass of people, which is what we've been doing by redistributing it over the last 40 years, if you then whack them with a tremendous crash in the year 2000, the so-called dot-com crash, and then another crash of the economy in 2008 or 9, the so-called subprime mortgage crash, and then another crash in the year 2020 when we got hit with the pandemic, and then you hit them with a pandemic, and then you hit them with an inflation, and now you propose to treat the inflation by raising the interest rates that the working class has to pay on the level of debt we've never seen before. You know what you've done? You have whacked the American working class uninterruptedly worse and worse over a period of 40 years. Of course the working class is going to react. Only people who have a very poor understanding of the working class would imagine any other reaction. More interesting is what the reactions are. And because we are a right-wing country, basically, our first reaction has been Donald Trump and the breakdown of our political consensus, as millions of Americans are enraged about their economic crisis, their decline, and the prospects for their children to be even worse. And so they turn to people like Trump, who promise a whole lot, deliver next to nothing. But there's another reaction, which is, let's change this system. Let's fight against the people who are giving us too little wages while they raise our prices, the employer class. And that's what you're seeing, the unionization, the strikes. That's the working class beginning to realize they've got nowhere else to turn but to themselves to demand a change in the way this economy has been treating them. The tragedy is only that it took so long for them to begin to understand that.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Richard Wolff, the economist, about the situation, the economic situation in the United States. Rick, let's talk about the rise of populist demagogues in our country, and not just Donald Trump. Who supports these people, and what parallels do you draw between the current situation in the USA and Germany as it developed in the 1930s?
I'm really glad you asked that question because it's in some ways the most important. What we are seeing is what we have seen before. The last time capitalism really let the working class down was in the so-called crash of 1929, a crash that lasted 11 years and plunged the working classes of Europe and North America and other parts of the world into the worst disintegration of their economic well-being that the system had ever seen. And it drove people crazy. The German working class had suffered the loss of World War I, the worst inflation in the early 1920s that we've ever seen. And so they were a whacked working class, and they began to be angry and desperate and militant, just like Jim asked about a few moments ago. And yep, there was a populist demagogue in Germany at the time named Adolf Hitler, who said to the working class, you're right, you have been abused, you have been whacked, you have been run through the ringer, and I'm going to tell you who it was. It was a foreigner in our midst, the Jews, the gypsies, homosexuals, all kinds of people he fingered as the scapegoats, and he said, if we can just get rid of them, either by deporting them or literally imprisoning and killing them, then our problems will be solved. And you know who has a parallel? We in the United States right now, because we've put our working class through the ringer, and we have the demagogues who stand up and tell us, oh, it's the immigrants. Unbelievable, the imagination here. We are a nation of 325 million people. We have at most 5 to 10 million undocumented immigrants. The idea that 5 to 10 of the poorest people in the world are what's causing our 325 million economy to be in trouble is so ridiculous, you have to wonder whether the people who believe it are drunk. They're not drunk. They're bitter, they're angry, they're upset, they have every right to be, they're desperate, and they will turn to anybody who promises them a way out. And we had better be careful, because Mr. Trump didn't fix their situation. Mr. Biden isn't doing it either, which means that these problems, the inequality, the lack of opportunity, are only getting worse. And if we don't come up with an alternative, we can expect the populist demagogues to continue to milk this situation here the way they did in Germany. And as we know, it did not end well in Germany, and it won't for the United States either.
You know, Rick Wolf, it seems to me that the $64 billion question, I wonder if you believe this, that so long as the U.S. and, well, much of the developed world is capitalist, isn't really equipped to deal with catastrophic climate change, nuclear Armageddon, the fears of it, well, great disparities in wealth that you've talked about, or the lack of housing, medical care, education, and all the rest. Under a capitalist system, can we hold out any hope of that being ameliorated?
Well, when you use the word can it, then my answer is, yeah, it could. It is conceivable. We do, as a nation, have the physical capability of doing that. We are a rich country. We have resources. We have a lot of the things you need to solve these problems. Will it happen? I don't think so. I don't think so, because this is a system, the capitalist system, that proudly tells you that it is a profit-maximizing, profit-driven system. We allow things as fundamental as our health care, our food, our basic transportation to be in the hands of corporations who tell you that their first priority is to make a buck, to make profit, to grow their company. That it's not to take care of our health or to deal with climate change and the damage we've done to the environment. They give you nice talk about how those are problems, and then they will explain to you they sure hope someone takes care of it, because they are busy doing what their priority is, which is to make money. Well, I've got the sad news then to give them and to everyone listening. They have been making profits very nicely, thank you, for quite a while now. That's why the United States is what it is. But they've in the process produced catastrophic climate change, great disparities in wealth, lack of housing, medical care, and education for tens of millions of people. So we know that a profit system can't do what we're talking about, not because it's physically impossible. They could do it, but as long as they support the capitalist notion that it's acceptable socially for the employer class, that 1%, not even, of our society, to control everything in the interest of profit, we're going to get profit, but we're going to get a system that doesn't work for the majority of the people.
Richard Wolf, what were the economic forces that helped bring about the Russian-NATO-American conflict in the Ukraine? And what role did the expansion of NATO after the Cold War ended and capitalism was restored to the USSR and Eastern Europe, what role did this play in bringing about this war?
Well, you know, the interesting way that you put the question comes from American history. The Cold War, the period roughly of after World War II, pretty much to the present, got us into this way of thinking that the great danger to the world was the conflict of socialism and communism on the one hand, represented by the USSR, and capitalism represented by Western Europe, the United States, and so on. And that war was somehow a product of the capitalism versus socialism. That's actually a very poor historical understanding. the worst wars in human history so far were World War I, when there was no socialist country, and World War II, when the Soviet Union was one among the dozen countries that produced that war. We used to call war the product of great power conflict, contestings between capitalist countries who were trying to build empires against one another or were competing in one industry or another. That's what we used to see as the cause of war. I think that's the way to see Ukraine. You have the United States and NATO trying to be expansionary, trying to grow their power, their extension. And you see the Russians, now a capitalist country again, as you rightly say, wanting to keep its boundaries secure, wanting to expand maybe if they can. And we're seeing the clash of these two great powers. The difference is, and this is crucial, the difference is that whereas the United States and Western Europe controlled the world economy after World War II, they don't anymore. That position of the United States is over. And I don't think most Americans, and indeed most Europeans, have come to terms with saying it. They're still mostly denying it. What we have now is a capitalist country, Russia, able to find allies to help them confront the much more powerful U.S. And Western Europe. And those allies for Russia are China, India, Turkey, Iran. You put them together, and suddenly we don't have what political scientists call a unipolar world. We have a multipolar or bipolar world. The United States is not playing the dominant position it once did. And I think that's the single most important lesson that the Ukraine war has to teach us. I only hope that we don't continue to deny the new position of the United States, because that is a very dangerous way to come to terms with the fundamental change that's all around us.
Well, Rick, look, we're getting near the limits of our time today, sadly, and I want to ask you what I guess is, again, the big question, you know, the old question, what is to be done? You very articulately indicated all the problems, the capitalist root of those problems, and so forth. We have two capitalist parties in the country today, and but we don't really have the kind of party, as you pointed out, that would make the differences that are needed. How do we go about doing that? Is there a possibility of us having our own political party independent of the capitalist Republicans and Democrats? And if so, what is it going to take to bring that about?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. The two political parties, as they both insist on telling us over and over again, are parties that believe in, that support, that subsidize, and that cheerlead for capitalism. And I think the inference you have to draw is, if you have two parties that dominate politics, and they both are supportive of capitalism, and you've had it now for a century or more, you have a system that has produced the very set of problems we've been talking about and that all Americans know. Therefore, what you need is change. And the change you need at core is to organize your economy around institutions that do not put profit first. Profit is what is earned by the employer class. The rest of us earn wages and salaries. They get profits. You have a system that makes the priority what a tiny minority gets. That's crazy if the majority are suffering conditions they want to change. So you need a political party that has the courage to say, we are not pro-capitalist. We do not believe that profit is the priority for anybody. And the first thing, therefore, we want to do is make a change in the way factories, offices, and stores, the business workplaces of our society, are organized. No longer run by a small group of people at the top, the employers, but rather run as a community by everybody who works at each workplace, and together do what's best for them as workers and for the communities in which they live. That's the priority, not profit, not private profit, but the collective well-being. We already take steps in that direction by making all our political leaders accountable to the rest of us. Why haven't we done that with the economic leaders inside all the enterprises? They too should be accountable to all of us, one person, one vote. If we did that, we wouldn't continue to both produce the problems we've been discussing in this program and seem so incapable of addressing them in an effective way.
Well said, Rick. Folks, we've been talking with Professor Richard Wolff on the economic situation in the USA. Unfortunately, we've come down to the last couple minutes. Rick, will you please take the last minute or so to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you?
Well, I'm part of a group called Democracy at Work. And what we do is advocate with all kinds of media, advocate for a transition in our workplaces from the top-down hierarchical capitalist arrangement with employers and employees into a different system, one that is based on a democratic community running our factories, offices, and stores. If democracy is good in politics, why the world haven't we got it in our economy, especially since the autocratic small group running every business has given us the very problems we've just discussed. So if you're interested in this, we've done loads of work, videos, audios, television programs, radio programs, articles, entire books. Just go to our website. It's called Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info, I-N-F-O, and all of our work, all of which is freely available, will be at your fingertips.
Great, wonderful, Rick. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us and for sharing your thoughts with us today on law and disorder. We greatly appreciate it. Thank you, Rick.
Well, thank you also for the opportunity, and I'm one of the many who appreciates the work you do all the time in bringing these kinds of conversations to the American public.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discussed. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As reported at the New York Times, less than 2 weeks into its tenure, Israel's new and extreme neo-fascistic right-wing government has already undertaken a wave of items from its far-right agenda. Items that are designed to weaken the judiciary, entrench Israel's control of the West Bank, and bifurcate the military's chain of command so as to give far-right ministers greater control of matters related to Israeli occupation. It is likely to have profound negative implications for the Palestinian people, as well as profound implications for the already dismal chances of finding a peaceful resolution of the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Even a great number of Israelis have grave concerns about its new government and what its announced plans may mean for them. Well, to help us understand just how extreme the new Israeli government is and what it will likely mean for the Palestinian people, we're fortunate to have as our guest today Sandra Tamari. Ms. Tamari is a Palestinian organizer and the executive director of Hadalah Justice Project. She is the co-chair of the steering committee for the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and from 2015 until 2018, and a lead organizer of the Palestinian contingent to Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. Sandra Tamari, a very warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Sandra, even before this new right-wing Israeli government came to power, last year Human Rights Watch and other such organizations categorized Israel as an apartheid state. What's the factual basis for that designation, and, well, what are its practical effects within Israel?
Well, first of all, apartheid is a international law definition. It refers to the implementation and maintenance of a system of legalized racial segregation, so in which one racial group is deprived of political and civil rights by another racial group. In Palestine and Israel, there are about 7 million Jewish Israelis and 7 million Palestinians that live between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. The situation is that there are two sets of rights. Israel is the sole governing power in all of that land, and it exercises primary authority over Palestinians. Across the areas and in most aspects of life, Israeli authorities methodically and systematically privilege Jewish Israelis and discriminate against Palestinians. So this goes down to the laws, the policies, the statements by leading Israeli officials. And they make it plain that the objective is to maintain Jewish-Israeli control over demographics, political power, and land. And so it's the pursuit of all of these goals that have rendered the decision by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, Palestinian civil society, and most of the international community that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid.
So, Sandra, Israel's also understood by many to be what they call a colonial settler state. Why is this the case?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question, because settler colonialism is the crux of the issue. Apartheid is a helpful framework. It helps us understand some of the picture, but doesn't paint the entire picture. Apartheid is merely the mechanism for the larger goal of settler colonialism. And so why do we call Israel a settler colonial state? Because primarily the state is about control of land and resources through forced displacement of indigenous people. Since the settler society, Israel, is primarily concerned with the control of land, what it seeks to do is forcibly remove or eliminate the indigenous Palestinian population and replace it with Israeli Jews. This has been the case since the founding of Israel in 1948. Israel has set out to control as much land in Palestine as possible and drive as many Palestinians from that land as it can. And to this day, Israel continues to steal land, construct Jewish-only settlements, expel Palestinians while cornering others into crowded ghettos, surround them by walls, military watchtowers, and checkpoints. Palestinians refer to the founding of the state of Israel as the Nakba. It's an Arabic word that means catastrophe. And what we say today is that the Nakba, which resulted in the forced expulsion of over 750,000 Palestinians who remain refugees outside the country, that the Nakba never ended. And so today, Israeli settler colonialism is the continuation of that catastrophe, the Nakba.
Mm. All right. Well, now let's then explore what Israel's new right-wing government is likely to mean for the Palestinian people. I mentioned in my introduction several features of the new government which are a grave concern to Palestinians, and understandably so. For example, it would weaken the Israeli judiciary. It would certainly appear to further entrench Israel's control of the West Bank, and could even lead to the government's take over the West Bank, and it would also give some far-right ministers greater control of matters related to the occupation. So I wonder, could you explain to us this the potential consequences of these and other plans of this new government for the Palestinian people?
Well, the election results in Israel reflect not only where the governing class in Israel is, but where the whole society is. Israelis are not concerned about the fate of the Palestinians. I want to make it very clear that there's no left in Israel, and there hasn't been for a long time. The most extremist members of this new government are downright frightening. The new Israeli government which is the most extremist, supremacist government in Israeli history, which is saying a lot because we just talked about the Nakba, we've talked about the continuing Nakba and the massacres against Palestinians. To say that this government is the most right-wing is a terrifying thing, and it's rapidly escalating its brutal attacks against Palestinians. This government is determined to fulfill the settler colonial goal of the state through violence, eliminating Palestinians at every turn. Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's been getting a lot of press, he's the new Minister of National Security, which includes policing in the West Bank and the border police, which control the barriers around Gaza. He's faced charges of hate speech against Arabs, and once known to have a portrait in his living room of Israeli-American terrorist Baruch Goldstein, the person who massacred 29 Palestinians in Hebron at the mosque. He's already begun to incite violence in his short time in office. He visited the Temple Mount, the Al-Aqsa compound, last week to stir up religious fervor around control of the holy site, around Al-Haram al-Sharif. And he has repeatedly called for the expulsion of Arab citizens of Israel who are not loyal to Israel, in his words. The new Minister of Finance, another extremist, Bezalel Smotrich, has negotiated a deal with Netanyahu, giving him almost complete reign over the future of the West Bank. I was really shocked. On December 28th, Smotrich wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal expressing clearly the goal of ending Palestinian Authority autonomy in Area C of the West Bank, contending what he said, a European Union-funded project to facilitate Palestinian takeover of Area C, which he said, quote, is the one part of the West Bank where Jews are currently permitted to live under the Oslo Accords. Well, this is really sickening subterfuge. According to the Oslo Accords, Area C is supposed to be temporarily under Israeli control, but come into Palestinian control. But what he's articulating to a U.S. audience is that his intention is to annex Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank. Smotrich, with his new finance position, will also be responsible for funding new settlements and denying Palestinians the ability to build homes on their land. So what we have is Smotrich, who's become de facto a prime minister of the West Bank, and Ben-Gvir, who will be holding the gun. We know that the coming period is going to be a very violent one.
Israel's new right-wing government will, of course, continue to benefit from the support that the United States gives it, military, economic, political support. Our country sends $4 billion in aid to the Israeli government every year. And then Israel turns around and uses that money to buy more military supplies from America. And weapons manufacturers sell it to them, and now the U.S. law is supposed to do something about it. The U.S. law says any country that violates human rights, such as Israel clearly does, is going to have to forfeit any financial support. That's never happened. Can you talk about that, please? Why isn't Israel held accountable under our own law?
There are laws. The Leahy laws are human rights laws that prohibit the U.S. Department of State and Department of Defense from providing military assistance to foreign units that commit human rights violations. But Israel has been set up for impunity. Special loopholes are built into U.S. military funding that allow Israel to continue to receive funding from the U.S. government, even when there's ample evidence that human rights violations are happening with U.S. weapons. There are three ways that they do this. U.S. security assistance to Israel is outlined in a very unique 10-year memorandum of understanding that commits the U.S. to billions in military aid years in advance. Congress made the U.S. commitment to the agreement binding this aid package in the annual defense spending bill. So it's very hard to challenge it. Secondly, unlike other countries that receive military financing from the U.S., Israel also receives its military financing in a lump sum, which is then distributed not to the Israeli government alone, but across Israeli military units. Because of this, The U.S. has no mechanism to track which weapons systems are going to which Israeli unit, making it nearly impossible to implement legally required human rights vetting under the Leahy law and to conduct legally required end-use monitoring. So we don't know how the money is being used exactly. There's no reporting requirement. And then finally, Israel is one of just a few countries that is allowed to use U.S. aid to buy weapons directly from U.S. arms manufacturers rather than through the U.S. government. So they can make deals with Boeing directly, they can make deals with Lockheed Martin directly, with other arms manufacturers, and they can avoid transparency requirements and other safeguards. All of these kinds of exceptions allow Israel to bypass the Leahy law and to receive funding with impunity.
Now, Sandra, you, of course, are a Palestinian American, and you were banned, though, from entering Palestine by the Israeli government in, I think it was 2012. What happened? And what does that represent?
I don't know if listeners understand that for anyone to enter into Palestinian territories, they must go through Israeli security. So I landed at the airport in Tel Aviv and was immediately, you know, met by an Israeli border patrol person and asked, because of the name, Tamari, because of the stamps in my passport, which included Arab stamps, what is the name of your father? What is the name of your grandfather? And when they heard Arab names, I was escorted to a waiting room where many, many Palestinians were waiting for questioning. I then was subjected to 5 interrogations over the course of 8 hours. And at the end of those 8 hours, I was declared a security risk to the state of Israel and taken to a detention center, put in prison overnight, and then deported the next day. This fits into the logic that I tried to describe earlier of Israeli settler colonialism. Any Palestinian is a demographic threat. Any Palestinian is a security threat to the state of Israel, given their logic of trying to replace the Palestinian population with Jewish Israelis. And the reality is that when I called the U.S. Embassy and I asked for assistance as a U.S. citizen born in the U.S., the first question that the officer on the other end of the line asked me was, "Are you Jewish?" And when I said no, then they said, "There's nothing we can do to help you." So we see that the U.S. government has adopted the same rationale, the same logic, the same racism that the Israeli government has in their services, their protection of American rights.
Sandra, you know, we hear a great deal about Israel and it being a democracy and how this new government might be a threat to the notion of Israel as a democracy. To what extent is Israel a true democracy? And I ask that as an American citizen, knowing that our own democracy is anything but pure. But what can you tell us about the supposed democracy of Israel?
There are an equal number of Jewish Israelis and Palestinians living in that land that Israel controls between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. Most of the Palestinians that live in that area do not have a vote in the Israeli elections. They do not have any say in the matters of the sovereign, the government, that is deciding, making very important decisions about the future of their lives, their fate. So there's no democracy in that. But even if we look at just in areas of Israel that were occupied in 1948, if we were to say, you know, yes, there is a vote, there are Palestinians that are citizens of that state, about 20% of Israeli citizens are Palestinians, those people do get to vote. What is their power? There has never been a ruling coalition inside of Israel that has welcomed an Arab party or, you know, a party into its coalition. The one exception is the last government, which did invite an Islamist party into its ranks. But that coalition is no longer in force, and what we have is we're back to a position where Palestinians do not have any say in the ruling coalition. We have a few members of Knesset, of the parliament, but we never have a Palestinian voice in this system. And most of Palestinians are disenfranchised and are not even asking, they're not asking for a vote. I think this is really important. When we talk about a future for Palestine and Israel, we're really talking about a decolonial process and not a democratization process. Palestinians are not simply asking for equal rights with their colonizers. They're asking for a complete dismantling of this system of apartheid, a complete dismantling of a system that is privileging one group of people over another. And so it's far from a democracy, but I think what this new government offers is an opportunity for people to see that. I think there's a lot of angst among supporters of Israel, even in the U.S. right now. This is really a moment where it's mask off. The government is not even making, the Israeli government is not even making an attempt to pretend that it's a democracy, and is not making an attempt to say that they're pursuing peace with the Palestinians. That's been the other kind of subterfuge that they've engaged in for a long time, that somehow if they had a partner for peace, then they could negotiate. Meanwhile, they continue to confiscate more and more land. I think right now, you know, that's the one glimmer of hope we see in the moment, is that perhaps because everything is becoming more transparent, more, you know, visible, that perhaps more people will begin to understand the Palestinian plight and understand the urgency of stopping Israel from continuing to commit these crimes.
Yeah, along those lines, Sandra, I wanted to read you three headlines in yesterday's Haaretz newspaper. Haaretz, as some of our listeners may know, is the liberal newspaper in Israel. And the three headlines I'm going to read to you, I want to ask you your reaction to them, are these. The one is, Palestinian father killed by Israeli army while attempting to halt son's arrest. Two, Israel clinic refuses first aid to Palestinian injured in workplace accident. And three, elderly Arabs hardest hit as report shows 2 million Israelis live below the poverty line. And then today I read that the Israelis are arresting children in the West Bank, children ages 12 to 16, beating them up and imprisoning them and intimidating them. And the Israelis say they do this because they want to create fear. So what's your reaction to the way the Haaretz has characterized these three latest Israeli actions and the children being beaten up?
It's a devastating time. For me, personally, I'll just speak from my own experience. I wake up every day wondering how many people I will see in the headlines, in my Instagram feed. Every day is another day where we see Palestinians martyred, dead, killed by the Israeli military. We're tired. Palestinians are absolutely exhausted. Some people have this idea that Palestinians and Israelis are separated, that we somehow have their walls, their checkpoints that keep us separated. But the reality is that the colonization of Palestinian land is so intense that there's no separation whatsoever. Settlers are living right next to Palestinian towns and villages. They share the same roads. They are in the same neighborhoods in Jerusalem, packed neighborhoods, where Israeli settlers are walking around in Palestinian neighborhoods as if they own it. And the tension is so intense and the proximity is so close that violence is happening everywhere. The settler has a gun, the army has a gun, the police have guns, and so Palestinians are waiting for a tragedy. That it doesn't even have to come to your home the way it came to this Palestinian father. His son was being arrested. He tried to get in the way of the soldiers taking away his son, and he was killed on his rooftop. But it could happen at any moment. You could be driving. You could be walking. You could be going to school. You could be going to work. And this violence is always present.
Well, Sandra, you, of course, are the executive director of the Adala Justice Project based here in the United States. I wonder, would you please describe the work of Adala and your ideas for how best to organize here in America against the plans of the new Israeli government and the ongoing occupation, And if our listeners are so inclined, how might they go to Adala's webpage and offer some support for the work of Adala?
Well, Adala Justice Project is an organization that believes in collective liberation. We believe that Palestine doesn't get liberated in isolation. So we're a feminist, diverse organization that is grounded in Black liberation, indigenous struggle, environmental justice, queer justice, and we find ways of creating coalitions that bring Palestinian issues to progressive circles. So, for example, we are very close with the Movement for Black Lives, and we had an opportunity, as you all remember, in the last couple of years to pressure Ben and Jerry's to finally pull all of its business out of the West Bank. When the Movement for Black Lives was approached by Ben and Jerry's to forge a partnership to talk about police brutality, the first thing they did is they came to us and other Palestinian partners and said, well, Ben and Jerry's wants this partnership. We're not going to do it until they comply with Palestinian demands. We see they're on the BDS list, the boycott list. What do you want them to do? And so we leveraged our relationship with Movement for Black Lives to push Ben and Jerry's to pull its business 100% out of Palestine, and now they're no longer operating there. So these are the kinds of ways that we build power. For people that are working in their community, there are ways to build coalitions. There are ways of organizing in whatever community that you're involved in, whether it be your workplace, your school, your church, your community group, to think about what is important to that group, whether it be fighting against police brutality, fighting for immigration reform. There are ways of making connections to Palestine and helping to push forward progressive agenda items that bring Palestine forward through the values that we all share. We are at adalajusticeproject.org, so A-D-A-L-A-H, justiceproject.org.
Ah, wonderful. Well, Sandra Tamari, as an American citizen who's just embarrassed and ashamed of the role my own government plays in the oppression of the Palestinian people, I thank you first for your work and for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Every success, you have our support and our solidarity, Sandra. Every success to you.
Thank you so much, Jim and Mike. Y'all are wonderful.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.